Back together again, you and I, kicking off a brand new week on Monday, January 13th, 2025, right here on Connecticut Today. I took a look at a bill that could see the General Assembly, in my opinion, grossly overstep its authority regarding private businesses in the state. CBS News correspondent Adam Yamaguchi joined us from Southern California with an update on the ongoing Los Angeles area wildfires. And Quinnipiac University Professor Emeritus of Journalism Rich Hanley talked about his new documentary, The Jump, premiering on CPTV.
So every 2 years, when you and I trot out or saunter out to our local polling places, and we don't pull the levers or the switches or the levers anymore, we fill in the little colored boxes there. We color it in with dark ink, black or blue. So that's how we vote. And we send women and men and some manner of human being to Hartford, whether you're a Democrat, a Green Party person, Independent Party, Republican, whatever you want to say, Communist, Democratic Worker Party, whatever acronyms you want to use. And we expect you folks in Hartford to make good use of your time and not go up there to Hartford with, frankly, things that 99% of the people in Connecticut couldn't give less of a crap about if they tried. But you have the grandstanders up in Hartford who come up with, you know, solutions for problems that aren't there. And I'm passionate about this because, you know, thankfully we don't have a full-time legislature. We're going to be in the short, we're already now, the General Assembly starting their meetings last week, and we're already now in what's called the long session, which goes till the end of May. So you have about 5 months, 5 months plus a week, or give or take a few days, whatever it is. And that's not a lot of time to get stuff done when you have to do a budget in a budget year. And this is going to be a contentious budget year, and get ready to slam down a shot of whatever you like to imbibe, because for every time you're going to hear the words fiscal guardrails, you can slam down a shot and feel real good at the lunacy. So why do I bring this up? Why do I start a brand new week with this on this Monday, the 13th of January, 2025? Well, it's a good reason to start because a lot of time, even in a long session of the General Assembly, you've got people suggesting stuff up there meaning Hartford, sorry for the geographic reference. You've got stuff up there that is some of the most asinine stuff you can ever read or digest in any way, and it doesn't have any real thing to do with how we conduct ourselves, you and I, Democrat or Republican, you know, people just trying to pay their bills, people worried about crime in the streets, people worried about repeat gun gangbangers, people worried in the state about being nickeled and dimed to death, and people worried about, geez, I have an idea, electric bills, but again, we'll get to that later. Because the environmental nuts on the left, they're digging in. So we have some update about that, too. But how about this story? And this is what I mean here. You have stories, and you have valuable time in Hartford that are going to be taken up by total wastes of time. And not only is valuable legislative time sucked up by this stuff, It is sucked up by legislators who want to bring stuff up to make themselves feel good. And along with it, carrying an arrogance about that, that they should dictate how other states conduct their business. Instead of getting their work, you know, getting their nose to the grindstone, as it were, and doing the people's work, we have this idiocy. Joshua Eaton's story in the Connecticut Post. You ready for this? Seriously, you ready for this? And I'll tell you why it's hypocritical here, especially if you say, well, that's a major issue, Paul. State lawmakers propose a ban on the sale and manufacture of lethal injection drugs. Now, with a myriad of stuff going on in this state, with crime still bad in some areas, with kids not able to read or write in many urban public schools, with controversy about gun ownership and what the rights are about private gun ownership, we're suddenly going to take up ostensibly time, valuable legislative time, to answer a problem that doesn't exist. Why? Because it makes people feel good. And the worst part is the outright arrogance of the Democratic leadership in Hartford to think they should have a say in what somebody lawfully can manufacture here in Connecticut and sell to another state. It is mind-numbing. We'll get into this momentarily. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. We're less than a week into this, folks, and the legislators in Hartford, mainly those of the majority party, are about to start wasting our time again. So at a time when a lot of people are figuring out, hey, can I pay my electric bill this month? Or, you know, what do I have to not buy at the grocery store this week because it's too expensive? Or, you know, at a time where you may have wait staff at certain restaurants or coffee shops saying, well, hey, is the General Assembly going to tell me I can't work for a lower wage because I like my tips, huh? Or at a time when the General Assembly really won't do anything despite the cops starting to say, well, you know, there may be a lot of marijuana being mixed out there with alcohol. No, none of those we're going to worry about, at least in the upfront part here. We're going to worry about, at least I'm told in this story, by some self-righteous jerks at the state capitol about exporting what they think about how Connecticut conducts itself to other states. Get this. And again, there's only, you know, there's only 20 weeks to get this stuff done. Three Democratic lawmakers have proposed a bill that would make it, get this, illegal in Connecticut to manufacture or sell any drug or medical device meant to carry out a death sentence. Really? That's what we're going to waste time on in Hartford? Three Democratic lawmakers, shocking, have proposed a bill that would make it illegal in Connecticut to manufacture or sell any drug or medical device meant to carry out a death sentence. Now, we don't have the death penalty in Connecticut. We don't have it. We got rid of it shortly after those two creeps did what they did in the Cheshire Home Invasion. And Governor Dan Malloy, believe me, Ned Lamont is a big step up from Dan Malloy. Oh, God. Remember Dan Malloy? Don't worry, the Cheshire Home Invasion people, they're going to stay on death row. No, they're not, Governor. And legal experts told you that. But you, again, the way you used to do with the budget on a consistent basis, you lied. But I digress. So now you have these self-righteous people, I have to be careful here, in Hartford, trying to tell legal manufacturers here in Connecticut that they cannot manufacture a product or sell it legally to another state. Are you kidding me? Honest to God, are you kidding me? Seriously, this is the same party that will practically do abortions at a drive-through window, and they're worried about death? Come on. Stop. This is the same party that won't extend more authority and power to police to get people who are high on marijuana off the roads, and they're worried about death? Really? Come on. This is comedy. The move comes after news reports from last year that the Hamden company Absolute Standards manufactured the lethal injection drug pentobarbital for use in legal injections by the Federal Bureau of Prisons during the first term of President-elect Donald Trump. Okay, who cares? Again, you Democrats in Hartford, why do you care? There are no, we're not going to have the death penalty in Connecticut anymore. You got rid of that. So now those dirtbags and others in the Cheshire Home Invasion have to live on the state dime for the rest of their lives. But no, that's not good enough. No, no, no. Absolute Standards seemed to confirm those reports, at least in part, in a letter last June to State Senator Saud Anwar of East Hartford and Democratic State Rep. Josh Elliott of Hamden. At the time, the company said it stopped manufacturing the drug in 2020 and had no future plans to make it or sell it. They wrote that to Anwar, Elliott, and other legislators. Despite, now, here's where the self-aggrandizing comes in, because, oh, we're going to be the white knight on a horse here. Despite that insurance, Senator Anwar said the new legislation is still needed to uphold Connecticut's long-held opposition to capital punishment. Really? Really? So we have no other problems here in the state, Senator, sir, with all due respect, then you're going to waste time telling a Connecticut-based company what it can and cannot manufacture. Is pentobarbital illegal? I don't think it is. Does the federal government still have the death penalty? Well, it does, sort of. Until Grandpa Joe gets out, thankfully one more week. Please, God, this can't end early enough. And we'll see what Mr. Trump does when he gets back in. The General Assembly banned any further death sentences in 2012, but did not revoke those already in place. The Supreme Court revoked those death sentences in 2015, and yes, proved that former Governor Dan Malloy was a lying jerk when he said, don't worry, it's not going to be retroactive. Of course it was. Anwar told a Connecticut Insider on Friday, this bill just confirms the values that the people of Connecticut have endorsed for quite some time. Now, wait a minute, Senator. I don't quite understand this. So you won't let a legal company here in Connecticut manufacture a legal substance to be sold to another state, which is not under your jurisdiction. And why? Because of Connecticut values? Some prime comedy right there. The bill is co-sponsored by Greenwich Democratic State Senator C.C. Marr and Josh Elliott of Hamden. So you have Josh Elliott from Hamden, Saud Anwar, and C.C. Marr, locally Fairfield County Legislature Darien, trying to dictate to other states what they should do and what the federal government should do. In a state that can't approve enough abortions fast enough, and suddenly we're worried about death. Really? In a state that keeps pushing for assisted suicide, and suddenly, though, we're worried about death. Okay. In a phone interview on Friday, C.C. Marr said Saud Anwar brought this issue to her attention long before the HBO News comedy show Last Week Tonight with John Oliver ran a segment about absolute standards last April, thrusting the issue into a spotlight. Oh, so we need to have legislation that's supported by an arrogant British comic. Is that the way we govern ourselves in the state? Who cares? Now, God bless John Oliver. He's a multimillionaire. Who cares? Oh, it was on John Oliver's show. Really? Whew, there's a bastion of journalism. Maher said, I just think this is something we need to do to make sure we here in Connecticut are living our values, which is that we don't condone the death penalty. No, 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 C.C. Maher, if you're listening, you don't condone the death penalty. How dare you and your compatriots speak for an independent business here in the state, which may be conducting business with other states of the federal government? Senator, with all due respect, that's none of your business. None. It's not a state-sponsored chemical. It's not coming from a state-sponsored or state-paid-for company. And the Democrats wonder why Donald Trump won again. Seriously, look at yourselves in the mirror. In a legislative session that we're going to have not enough time to address everything, we're already seeing the finger-pointing about energy policy and all this, we're going to worry about chemicals for death sentences when none of it takes here, it takes place in the state. Seriously, Senator Marr, Josh Elliott, Senator Anwar, do us all a favor. I'm saying this seriously. Stop with the Connecticut values thing. Could we stop that? And Governor Lamont does it, and former Governor Malloy did it. Could we please? What are Connecticut values? Letting multi-time gun criminals run around on the street? Is that Connecticut value? What's a Connecticut value? Letting black and Hispanic kids graduate when they can't read or write? Oh, that's a Connecticut value. Why don't we do that? No. What's a Connecticut value? Inviting women from other states? Hey, come to Connecticut and we'll kill your kids. Well, why not? But we're worried about lethal injection drugs. Come on. Come on, please. This is a special level of comedy here. And here in Connecticut, we watch from afar. And again, the images we see of these Los Angeles County wildfires, just crazy, deadly fires. And now those Santa Ana winds whipping up again. And joining us right now from that area, CBS News correspondent Adam Yamaguchi is with us. Adam, good afternoon, and thank you for joining us. How are you, sir?
Good afternoon. I'm well, though the situation here remains really, really on high alert. As you mentioned, those dreaded Santa Ana winds are expected to kick back up later this afternoon. And the National Weather Service has issued its highest red flag warning designation, the particularly dangerous situation, as they call it, which is expected to come in overnight and into tomorrow evening. So not out of the woods by any means.
So, Adam, will these winds, are they projected to be high enough that it will ground any helicopters or water dumping planes in the area? Will it just be not safe enough to fly, or do we know that now?
Well, this wind event that we're expecting overnight is not expected to be as powerful as what we experienced last week. It is, of course, going to impact the same areas that have been burned, and could potentially increase some of the fire lines as well as the evacuation lines, because, again, the fires are still far from being contained and abut major residential areas. So whether the winds will ground those operations, it's not entirely clear, though, again, this isn't expected to be as strong. Sustained winds anywhere between 30 to 40 miles with wind gusts in excess of about 70 miles per hour. So still quite powerful forces that the firefighters are going to be up against.
And Adam, stripping away the fire for a moment, these Santa Ana winds, I mean, they are seasonal, right? They do get this high. So the wind speeds in and of themselves, correct me if I'm wrong, this has not been seen. It's not like this hasn't been seen before, correct?
You are correct. The Santa Ana winds are a natural phenomena. Although what's different this time around is we shouldn't be seeing them have the kind of impact that they're having right now. It's really the combination of those dry winds, but also the fact that right now, I mean, in January, we should be in flood season.
Wow.
This is, you know, just last year, we were dealing with massive floods at this time. We have seen virtually no rain. We are typically at this time of the year, in the water season, we should be up over 5.5 inches of rain. We've only clocked 0.16 inches of rain. So, again, it's those winds and the fact that there's just so much dry brush and vegetation that just fuels these winds and fires.
The fear, and we're talking with CBS News correspondent Adam Yamaguchi from the L.A. area, Southern Cal. So I guess, Adam, now the fear is, despite the number of deaths that are already connected to this, I guess, and I read there's a fear there of what may be found later on, fearing that there are at least people that have been reported as missing, right?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things that's happening on the ground in the evacuation zones, which, again, are still closed to people, residents who desperately want to get in, they're being kept out for a number of reasons. But one of them is that investigators are combing through the area. They are going house by house with cadaver dogs in some cases, looking for any human remains and looking for those missing people. So the tolls are unfortunately expected to rise as these authorities continue their work.
And finally, Adam, to go to the inevitable finger pointing, which has already begun. I mean, you and I know it's already in high gear here. What's the dynamic of that? I mean, you have soon-to-be president again, Trump, weighing in. You've got Governor Newsom. You've got Karen Bass. You've got tension now between the mayor's office and the fire department. My guess is, thankfully, once these fires are finally out, there are going to be a lot of reports maybe issued on this. What's the temperature of that out there regarding that?
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of sniping publicly as well as, over social media amongst all those that you had just pointed out. But I think that the sense that we get up from the ground is that a lot of the tough questions, yes, they're being lobbed now. Yes, there is finger pointing. But I think everyone recognizes that there is a duty, there's a job to be done now, which is to prevent further catastrophe from spreading. And so, again, those tough questions will continue to surface throughout. But at this point, you know, they've all got a job at hand.
Yeah. CBS News, Adam Yamaguchi. Adam, thank you. Be safe. And hopefully we can talk down the road. But be safe, sir. And thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Adam Yamaguchi there from SoCal, from L.A. there. And yeah, it's again, those Santa Ana winds. Welcoming back a friend of the radio station here, Professor Emeritus of Communication, Rich Hanley from Quinnipiac University in Hamden. Not to talk about something necessarily in the news, breaking in the media landscape, but Rich, you may know, you may not know, he's been a wonderful documentary producer over the years. His documentaries have caught national acclaim, and he really tends to concentrate on stuff here in Connecticut and stories that you may not know of or that may need retelling. Did a wonderful documentation on the final days of the New Haven Coliseum years back. I have a copy of that. You should pick that up. He's done previous work, and his new work is called The Jump. That's it, T-H-E-J-U-M-P, The Jump, and it premieres tonight on Connecticut Public Broadcasting, and then I guess is going for national distribution. Rich Hanley's with us. Rich, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Great to be here.
Great to have you on, Rich, all the time, and I keep reminding people on and off the air to watch your stuff. These are really labors of love. Before we get to this, to The Jump, the specifics of it, and I kind of have a, you know, because I'm in the business and I understand how long this stuff takes, but to do, say, a good one-hour documentary, what are we talking time-wise? From the moment you say, let's do this until the debut is generally how long?
Well, it generally is a few years. Because of the volume of research that has to go into not only the story, mm-hmm. but also into finding visuals, archival photos, archival film, and so on, then shooting stuff, visuals in the contemporary sense, plus the interviews, fact-checking, you know, and so on, writing the script. So it takes quite some time.
And that can be can be kind of lost on people, Rich, because everybody hears, you know, in the audio business, podcast, but that's good. I mean, that's only the audio, but just to even find some of these visuals can be a real labor of love, and I guess it would be frustrating from time to time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, just you think about audio only, you don't have to think about 75% of the job, because mm-hmm. if you don't got pictures, you don't got a story. You can't really afford recreations, that sort of thing, and or use AI to replicate someone's voice, as if you have a $20 million budget you can do. You have to find the real stuff. And for this documentary called The Jump, you know, we went to Los Angeles, South Carolina,
wow.
Chicago, Toronto, Norway, just to get some visuals. Now, other places, too, of course.
Yeah.
Just National Archives in College Park, Maryland. Just to find visuals to help move the story along and make it visually rich. So the stuff doesn't come out and say, here I am. You have to go dig and look for it, including some really, really obscure stuff that's essential to storytelling. But we found it. It took a long time.
Yeah.
But we found it, and we were able to stitch it together into a coherent narrative.
Quinnipiac University Professor Emeritus of Journalism, Rich Hanley, longtime friend of mine and friend of the show and the radio station, on with us right now, talking about a new documentary, The Jump, that he produced and put together. Another one of his great lines of documentaries premieres tonight on CPTV. Rich, what is The Jump, and where is it?
The Jump is in Salisbury, Connecticut, tucked away in the northwestern corner there between New York and Massachusetts, sort of isolated area of the state. Has a very, very interesting history of Scandinavian immigration there. And the story is about there are two plot twists to it. One is how the tradition of ski jumping started in Salisbury.
Mm-hmm.
It started in the 1920s, and how the town saved the tradition of ski jumping around 2010, when the physical jump started to fall apart, and they had to make a choice: either continue to jump by building a new one, or just put the tradition aside and leave it to historians. And the main character in this is a guy by the name of Roy Sherwood, a local Salisbury native. He quits high school because he loves ski jumping, just wants to ski jump.
Yeah.
Goes on to win the national championship in 1954, which immediately qualifies him for the Olympic team in 1956 in Cortina, Italy. And he goes to, you know, gets the official letter, he's on the team. Then he gets polio.
Oh,
and so the story goes how he overcame this thing and how he overcame the disease, how he overcame an injury just before the games themselves in Cortina. And he kind of reflects the spirit of the town. Can do. We can do whatever we need to do to achieve a goal, whether to win, you know, to qualify for the Olympics or to rebuild a ski jump. So it's really a story of small town America banding together through volunteer organizations to achieve, to continue a tradition that's a really, really important part of the town's identity.
So, Rich, what drew you to this story? I mean, I'm sure a guy like you, your mind's always going, I could do this, I could do that. Yeah, that's easier to do. What's up with that? Somebody mentioned this. How did you get drawn to that?
I just found it to be an odd story. Number one, like ski jumping in Connecticut. Well, that's a trip. You know, who thought of that? I remember hearing about it when I was growing up.
Yeah.
In Connecticut, that they did some ski jumping, and it was like that. It was very exotic. And then, you know, fast forward to like 2008, 2009.
Yeah.
And then I read news all the time, and I read local accounts of a fundraising drive to save ski jumping. And I said, well, that's a story. A small town trying to save its tradition. That's automatically a story. And I had heard the name Roy Sherwood, but I didn't know him personally or had read much about him. So in 2012, we went up there and we filmed interviews, filmed the town, snow, everything, and really retraced the journey of the town and Roy Sherwood in their lives and their desire to continue ski jumping. And the two intersect. On one night in 2010, and that kind of brings the two parallel plots together, and it really is a study or an entertaining study, if you will, you know, in what you can do with volunteers, and if you really want something and you want to work together toward achieving that goal in sports, you can achieve it, both in terms of the athletic aspect as well in civic pride.
Quinnipiac University Professor Emeritus Rich Hanley joining us. His latest documentary airing tonight on CPTV. It's going to get national release as well, The Jump. So, Rich, at the time this was happening and he was qualifying for the Olympics in Cortina, Italy, between 54 and 56, I mean, was the ski jumping world, were they cognizant of, this little town in Connecticut where this is going on? Because I would imagine it was still prominent or more prominent back then, correct me if I'm wrong, in Northern California and Colorado and Idaho or not. How prominent was that Connecticut jump?
In the eastern United States, it was very prominent.
Okay.
There was, eastern national competitions were held there. All the best jumpers in the United States would go there to compete every year. In an annual event, it was up there at the time in the 50s. Ski jumping was popular in northern New England, obviously Lake Placid, New York, you know, the 32 Olympics, and whatnot. And Nordic sports, you know, had a sort of renaissance in the 50s. You know, in the late 40s there were movies. You know, it happened in Sun Valley and stuff like that, and that popularized Nordic sports. It also popularized Nordic fashions.
And the big big bands helped too.
Yeah, you bet. And so Salisbury became almost a winter pilgrimage for people from the east to come watch ski jumping because it was so exotic. Actually, if you go back to the 1930s, you know, in Boston Garden, Madison Square Garden, and even
indoors.
New Haven, they would jump indoors. and we cover that. In the film, you know, people in urban areas would watch these guys go down a slope and, built just for indoors, and it was just fascinating. But in the 50s, it had a golden age, and it influenced fashion and so on and so forth. So Salisbury really was a destination, not quite like a resort that you would find in California, Northern California, Utah, or Colorado. But it had small-town charm, and thousands of people would go to watch ski jumping in the 1950s.
And Rich Handley, you know, back then, and you watch it through the modern day, Rich, you got to be a little nuts to do that. Not maybe all the way off the rails, but you know, when I saw the trailer and I saw the first-person camera, and I've always said to myself, this is, I mean, open-wheel Indy cars and Formula One and NASCAR. You know, at least you're glued to the ground to a point. These guys and gals that do this, and I would imagine they were considered somewhat of a daredevil back then. You got to be a little good kind of crazy to do this.
Absolutely. I mean, just going up to the top of the tower, so you're going to ski down this and then fly and then hope to land softly without, you know, breaking bones and whatnot. It takes a tremendous amount of courage, and there's a lot more technique involved than it seems. You know, the way you lean forward over the skis and have to move the bindings in a certain way and then land a certain way, because you're judged not only on distance but also on form. So it's a it's quite the sport.
Yeah.
It's not as popular now as it had been in the 1950s, say, but it still attracts a lot of young jumpers. And every 5 years, Salisbury hosts the Junior Nationals. So skiers from the Rocky Mountain region, et cetera, they know the upper Midwest, New York State, upper New England, come down to Salisbury and compete. And it's quite the event with the amount of jumpers. You know, you have over 50 jumpers competing for a national championship. This is the first step toward qualifying for the Olympics. Then they have to go to the national championships and try to get a spot on the Olympic team.
Nice. So,
it's a stepping stone. It's a stepping stone to the Olympics for a lot of young jumpers.
From all in Little Salisbury, Connecticut, of course.
Salisbury, Connecticut.
As Rich said, great history. So, Rich, CPTV tonight. What time again? Refresh me on that.
It's tonight at 10 p.m. It'll be repeated Saturday at 7 p.m.
Excellent. Now, which studio is buying the movie rights to this? Because this sounds like an incredible story with your protagonist. Listen. Can I be on your security team, Rich? When you hit, but seriously, I mean, this like it done right, this could be an amazing story.
It is an amazing story, and it would be tremendous visually.
Yeah.
To recreate the atmosphere of the 1950s.
Yeah.
You know, with all the fashion and so on, and just the way people approached things at that period of time. You know, this is television was still in its relative infancy.
Sure.
So people had to go and see stuff and experience stuff. And athletes had to really, really work in a different way without coaches often to aspire to, you know, to Olympic fame. So there's a lot here. There's a lot here for maybe not a contemporary Hallmark Channel movie, but certainly there's a story here that Hollywood needs to tell, because it's a classic hero's journey at a time when the architecture is interesting, the fashion is interesting, the music is interesting, and so on. So
I think, Rich, if you contact Timothy Chalamet, he can do Bob Dylan ski jumping there. You think that would
have him jump with guitars on his legs,
and he'll do it. He'll do it electric just to tick people off, right? Hey, Rich Handley, Rich, I'll be watching tonight. Thank you, my friend. Be good, and we'll keep reminding people about this. Thank you, Rich.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it.
Professor Emeritus Rich Handley, longtime buddy of mine, Quinnipiac University. It's called The Jump. Tonight, 10 o'clock on CPTV. It's going to be repeated numerous times. It's going to get released across the country. The role and that little old Salisbury, Connecticut played over the years for you ski jumpers.